The picture on the front of the New York Times website and the front page of the paper said it all yesterday. A little Syrian girl peering into a camera next to a pile of rubble, and the caption about her returning to the bombed-out city of Aleppo to find her home gone. Now this Syrian civil war, it's making its way into the center of Damascus, once again the government stronghold, and the latest deadly explosions right outside of the headquarters of President Bashar al-Assad's ruling party. 72 dead in yesterday's attacks, but also the attack on civilians in Damascus by some faction, perhaps of the opposition, has pointed up once again the divisions within the coalition that wants to take power from President Assad. How is this war being conducted? Does anyone know? With us now is Abigail Fielding-Smith, reporter for the Financial Times. Abigail, welcome to the program.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
From Beirut, is it possible to know who is conducting this war? There seems to be, once again, a division between some aspects of the opposition that want to avoid attacking civilians and these latest attacks.
Well, I think division is putting it mildly, actually, John. I think the whole opposition is so fragmented into so many different groups, both political and military, and then fragmentations within the military along ideological, personal grounds. So it's actually very difficult to talk about the coherent position of the opposition at all.
News reports speak every day of the center of Damascus, the government stronghold. What are we talking about here? And if I was to walk from the center of Damascus to some of the suburbs that are under opposition control, what would I see?
Well, for a start, you'd have to go through a lot of checkpoints to get there. But yes, once you get through those checkpoints, from what we've been seeing, from what little independent reporting has come out, are scenes of terrible devastation, places sort of bombarded to rubble in some cases.
So inside this center Damascus bubble, we're talking, what, 10 blocks, 20 blocks? And outside of it, it can be a complete rubble.
Well, I mean, it's not quite like that geographically. I mean, central Damascus is quite a bit larger, and the suburbs are kind of towns which are nearby. But, I mean, certainly the sort of distinction between the two is starting to blur somewhat, which we saw in the most recent push in from Jobar in the east, an area sort of on the eastern outskirts, where fighters managed to actually apparently push through as far as Abbasid Square, which is a kind of main traffic hub in Damascus proper. The devastation isn't quite as sort of like a matter of being just a few blocks from the city center, but it's coming nearer all the time. I think that's the key point.
What is the sense from Beirut of the source of weapons for the opposition? There have been reports that because of the international coalition, which at least tacitly supports or explicitly supports without action the opposition, some floodgates, some pipelines of weapons have been opened.
Well, I think that they get them from a number of different sources. A lot of them are simply bought inside Syria. There's a flourishing internal arms market in Syria, a lot of which is coming from captured bases. So they're actually using weapons captured from the regime. I get the impression that it's the captured weapons that are making more of a difference than any deliveries from outside. But it is very hard to tell from Beirut. But certainly talking, you know, in as much as we can tell, that does seem to be the pattern.
Talking with Abigail Fielding-Smith, a reporter for the Financial Times. Before we go, it does appear that the bombings yesterday targeted, aside from presidential installations, perhaps the Russians, who seem to be holding fast with Bashar al-Assad, albeit with some reservations.
Yeah, I mean, it was near the Russian embassy, and the Russian embassy was damaged in the attack. I don't know if that was a target, or it was also near the Ba'ath Party, the ruling party headquarters. But certainly, I mean, Russia is seen as being part and parcel of the regime by those fighting it. And as you say, there's no real clear evidence that Russia's shifted its position, which is that there must be a negotiated solution to this and Assad's future can't be predetermined, whereas the opposition say that the only thing that they can negotiate on is Assad's departure.
Abigail Fielding-Smith, a reporter for the Financial Times on the latest in Syria. She spoke with us from Beirut, Lebanon. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Tony Badran joins us now. He's a research fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Tony.
Thank you.
So listening to Abigail there and just thinking about what's been transpiring and how it seems to move into a state of higher brutality and more of a stalemate. This is beginning to look like a lost generation, not unlike what happened in the civil war in Lebanon in the 70s.
I mean, absolutely. That's the closest analogy, I would think, to the situation in Syria. Only, you know, unlike in Lebanon, where you had where the militias were at least funded by established notable political families, the militias in Syria are far more diverse. But the move now into Damascus has been a long time coming. I mean, first they moved to Aleppo, which is the biggest city and sort of the economic center. They still haven't taken it over entirely, but they've essentially pushed out most of the regime elites from there. And now, slowly but surely, they're trying to move into Damascus, which is Assad's stronghold, and specifically into a military airport of Mezzi, which is very near Damascus as well.
So, Tony Badran, if we're going to use the Lebanon example, I mean, Lebanon was able to maintain its constitutional rule of law system even during the entire civil war, and the reconstruction of Lebanon really took place within that framework. In Syria, the entire governmental structure is probably going to have to be thrown out if Bashar al-Assad goes.
Absolutely. I mean, Syria, unlike Lebanon, because of the long, long dictatorship of the Assad regime, and before it, a series of military coups, has essentially stripped this current generation of any knowledge whatsoever of constitutional democracy or anything resembling that. In fact, there's a lot of people in the United States who talk in the government, I mean, who talk about preserving state institutions, which is not only fanciful in practical terms, but even it's in terms of actually what's desirable in Syria. It's completely undesirable because the state in Syria is synonymous with the Assad family and a very small clique of that family and security officers around them. So if you're going to have a new Syria once that family is defeated, you're going to have to overhaul that entire system.
Well, the takeaway there from Tony Badran, I misspoke. It's not a single lost generation. If you count the generation lost by being stripped of political authority under the dictatorship of Bashar al-Assad, it's two lost generations from the civil war and the rule of the Assad regime. And Tony Badran is a research fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies in Washington, D.C. Thanks, Tony.
Thank you.
So we want to update you on a couple of things. Oscar Pistorius, the accused murderer and Olympic athlete in South Africa, at a bail hearing that took 4 days in Pretoria, South Africa, has been granted bail. The first step, scoring one, I suppose you might say, for Oscar Pistorius in the murder trial, which is expected to be watched by the entire world, of Oscar Pistorius, accused of killing his girlfriend in his own home by firing 4 gunshots into a bathroom, where she was found later and died on the way to the hospital. Oscar Pistorius granted bail. More on this and all the news. Stay with us. This is The Takeaway.